This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living, and it's Friday, which means that our doctor in the house is here, except not quite. Today, actually, it's just me, Lee Chui Lin, as well as our Health and Living producer, Tina Camellia. And it is Friday, which means we would never deny anybody their regular dose of Dr. George Lee. And in light of that, since we're taking a look, this is kind of a best-of series of Health and Living, and today it's part one of the best of Dr. George, who is our weekly regular, so we see him a lot.
So Mira and Dr. George spoke to famed cardiothoracic surgeon Tan Sri Dr. Yahya Awang. It was more of a personality piece to discuss his illustrious career. He comes from a very well-known family, so we ask what his upbringing was like and how it influenced his career choice.
Your father was Penang State Governor Tun Datu Dr. Haji Awang Hassan, and your uncle is the former Deputy Prime Minister Tun Dr. Ismail Abdul Rahman. What was it like growing up in a family with so many influential people?
Well, I felt perhaps a little bit privileged, but I had all the opportunities. They provided the opportunities for me to advance myself in all aspects, and especially in my career.
Mm.
And I think that was the positive aspect of it. But I was treated like any other young boy growing up, and we mixed around with just about everybody in our surrounding area. I lived in a mosque area next to a hospital, and it was a very mixed society. Although I would say that I was a little bit more privileged in the sense that I went to school by car, and I had somebody to cook for me.
Yeah.
But otherwise, my upbringing was just the same like others. I mixed around. We played football with all the boys around.
Why cardiology?
Well, my family are doctors. I sort of floated into medicine. Even when I was young, I was fascinated by my father and my brother. They always talk about sick person over dinner. And so naturally, I was very interested.
Well, it's not just cardiology, it's cardiothoracic surgery.
Surgeon, yes.
That's right, mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, one thing that you mentioned is obviously a very prominent family. And one thing I would like to add, how I link to this, because I always have to link urology to the Friday show,
yes. Is
that Tan Sri has a very prominent brother as well, who is a very well-known urologist who set up, who is instrumental in the founding person, for the Institute of Urology and Nephrology in the in GHKL.
Wow.
Yeah. So
okay.
Very prominent and contributing families.
Yep.
At the heart of the interview was a BBC article about a man who recently died, but not before living 33 years with his transplanted heart, earning him a Guinness World Record. So we found out what the harvest and transplant processes were really like and how much of that has changed.
Well, the main challenge was to get the organization correct. Because transplant requires a lot of teamwork. You require a team that to go to harvest. You require a team to get the recipient ready for transplant. And also we have to look into the ischemic time. We can't get a donor, say, from East Malaysia and fly here.
Dantri, I recall, my time when I was in Oxford being a trainee, somebody called me up and said, look, you're on call for harvest. And then, so can you get ready tonight? We're going to go, because we tend to do this in the middle of the night.
Yes, yes,
and then,
true.
So they said to me that, so you're going to go to Boston. And then I was in Oxford. I was quite excited that we're going to go to Boston. And then, but actually it was Boston, Lincolnshire, rather than Boston, Massachusetts. And then my boss, I remember vividly telling me, say, look, I don't think you're very bright, are you? Because the ischemic time will be way too long for you to take a 7 hours transatlantic flight.
And what is the maximum ischemic time?
Well, they say it's 5 hours, but the shorter it is, the better the chances of success. Yeah. And the results will be better.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a donor which is close to your hospital, and your ischemic time, as they say, is less than an hour. Yeah. I mean, your chances of success is good.
33 years is great. I mean, living after a heart transplant.
Yeah, our second transplant patient is still alive. I think he's about 14 years now, 15 years.
Right.
He's an Indian man. He was also ill with end-stage cardiac heart disease. And he received a heart from Ipoh. It was, I think it was one of our hockey players in the past. He was young, fit, and he died of a motorcycle accident. Mm. And so the donor, the recipient team went to harvest the heart in Ipoh. Yeah. And Ipoh wasn't that long. I think the ischemic time was less than 3.5 hours. Mm. And he's done very well.
Right.
That's true. You know, for this BBC article, basically the person who survived this is now aged 73. I mean, he said he wanted to be inspiration for people who donate and also for Medical Frontier. I mean, in fact, his procedure was actually done by Professor Madi Yaqub.
Yes.
It was like, have you come across him in your career?
Yes. I used to work at the Brompton Hospital, and he was one of the cardiac surgeons there. And over the weekends, he normally operates in his private setup.
Sector,
in one of the suburbs in London. And on many weekends, I used to go there and have a look at how he does. I think he was born to operate.
That's right. I remember watching from a distance, you know, as a urologist, when we do the harvesting, and then we're the last person to actually get. Basically, essentially, they will get the cardiothoracic surgeon flying from in a helicopter and then trying to, you know, get the organ. So they will do the, you know, the sternum opening and then thoracotomy and then basically take the heart out. And then I remember vividly everyone was surrounding it and with him holding the heart, you know, and then, you know, people think cardiothoracic surgeons have God complex. You know, sometimes they think they are God.
Because a
lot of problems.
You're literally
problem.
Holding that's the heart in your hand.
In your hand, because the heart is pumping away. This is a brand new heart. It's pumping away. And then after the heart is taken away, the helicopter fly off. And then, you know, then the liver surgeon will come into all the perfusions. And then afterwards, the patient is left there. And then the urologist will come in to take the kidney. So usually we're the last.
Right.
But it is quite a privilege to see how, you know, the surgical meticulousness of surgery is carried out in action.
Give me an idea. I mean, so you went to harvest in the first heart transplant. You harvested.
No, one of my other surgeons went to harvest.
Okay.
I was getting the
recipient
ready.
Okay.
So I've opened his chest. I've put him on a heart-lung machine and ready to remove his sick heart.
Right.
And the timing must be good. As soon as the recipient donor heart is close to the hospital, there'll be a signal to say that the heart is coming. Then at that point of time, I'll remove the sick heart. And then when it arrives, we will sew in the new heart.
How long can we live without, once you have removed the heart in between?
Well, because once you remove the heart, you are on a, what we call a heart-lung machine, so that you can, you know, you can go on with
artificially.
Mm-hmm. 3 or 4 hours, no problem.
Okay.
But for the recipient heart, the donor heart, the ischemic time, as Dr. George says, should be as short as possible. So the sooner you sew in the new heart onto the recipient, the better. The
you make it sound so simple. It's not just sewing
it
in. I mean, how do you?
Many, many years.
Yeah.
For me to be comfortable in handling the heart.
You have held many beating hearts.
Yes, I know many people.
That's your job.
I know many people inside out.
Yeah.
Literally. Including to Marte.
Yeah.
If those days you did not take risk, you did not kind of like venture into the unknown, then IGN would not have existed.
Of course.
Yeah, because, you know, you have to take on those complicated cases. You have to be a first person, you know, with everybody, all the team, the rest of the team, not really knowing what it was like for you to guide it. I mean, so it's natural for you to take a bit of risk, but like you said, you know, stratified risk in order to make sure patient safety is paramount.
That's definitely true. And especially so when we first started heart surgery, we were dealing with a lot of neglected cases. You know, we have cases that have missed out, especially you say that they have a hole in the heart and then you have reverse shunting, as you say. So there were many cases that were neglected. They would have had surgery earlier if we had the facilities. Mm-hmm. The big question was, should we perform or have they missed the boat? And if they haven't, what are the risks? The risk is higher if you leave it longer.
I've always wondered, with all these advancements and, you know, with so many experts coming out, do you think that's one of the reasons why we are also complacent on the other side of the divide? I mean, we take it for granted. If I become a heart case, there will be solutions, and so I will not really care. I mean, what
I would kick, you know, I would take that extra cake.
Yes,
then and not
I will
worry
take the
much.
Extra cake. There will be people like Tan Sri there to help me, you know, live longer. That kind.
I think
of
it's
Tan
important.
Sri, please help me live longer.
I think it's important to educate the public that if you have risk factors for heart disease, or if you have known problems with the heart. Results are always better if you have it done earlier rather than leave it later.
Okay.
You are listening to our Best of Health and Living 2016 series. Today is the Best of Dr. George Lee, just part one. Don't worry, there's more to come. But today it's all about cardiovascular health. It's all about smoking. And that is what we'll be looking at after this, smoking. Or rather, how to quit smoking. You are listening today to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me is Health and Living producer Tina Camellia, not quite Dr. George Lee today.
I try.
You do. I can see it. But we are bringing you the best of Dr. George Lee 2016, at least. So we had a panel about smoking.
Yes. And we talked about smoking cessation, lung cancer, these topics a lot on our show. But still, you know, every now and then you get callers who try to defend smoking.
I get very upset at that.
I know. So we realized that shows like this, they need to keep going so that we can keep the conversation going. So there was a new study that showed the best way to quit. First, we start with the quit rate.
The quit rates, okay. So we were talking a little bit before this and I thought they were low. It turns out they're not. But so it's 22%, as you mentioned, and 15.5%. I spoke
in 6 months, right?
In yes. 6 months.
Yeah.
I spoke to lead researcher Dr. Nicola Lindzen-Hawley about how she and her team could convincingly conclude from that that cold turkey is the best way to quit smoking, and this is what she had to say.
The numbers are quite low, but that is generally what we expect in smokers. So that's kind of in line with what we usually see when people use the UK Stop Smoking Services to stop smoking. And it just reflects the fact that whichever way you try and quit, it's a very, very difficult thing to do. But yeah, so we concluded that if you quit all at once, so abruptly, then you are more likely to be successful. So at 6 months, people were 42% more likely to quit if they quit abruptly than if they quit gradually.
So this number, 22%, then, mm-hmm. You know, I put it to her that it was low. I put it to you that it's lower. And apparently I'm very naive. So
I mean, for non-smokers, presumably we would imagine this utopia of, like, you know, 80, 90%.
Oh, God, no.
Associate Professor Dr. Mohammad Haniki Nick Mohammed, pharmacist and smoking cessation expert, and Dr. Zariha Mohammed Zain from MyWatch explains why this quit rate, while not encouraging, is actually very normal.
You have to understand that smoking has been a classified as an addictive disease.
Mm.
It's actually under the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's actually a psychiatric disease. So smokers are actually...
So for those listening out there,
yeah.
You know, it's a psychiatric condition when you're a smoker,
yes.
Addicted to smoking.
Yeah, it's a mental and behavior disorder. Yeah.
Ah, not in addition to that, is a mental and behavior disorder.
I know, this is really multifaceted. The numbers, though, that she's citing and within the study, is that about what you expect to see here in Malaysia? I mean, when you run your clinics, is that about right?
Yep. Because in Malaysia, the Ministry of Health offers free quit smoking clinics services available. I think the last average that they got is about 13 to 15% quit rate. And an earlier compilation from, for example, Professor Robert West from UK showed that if you look at the success rate of people quitting on their own, unassisted, the success rate can reach up to 5% at best.
Uh-huh.
So that's even much lower.
Yeah.
And it can go higher, maybe 10 to 15% with some support. That would include in the sense of behavioral. Medication and behavior. But if you get specialists, like here in this study, they also have a nurse who's providing therapy.
Right, okay.
Behavior therapy on top of medication, and it's not just monotherapy.
All right.
They have combination of the medication because they put the patients on a patch as the baseline,
okay.
And then that is topped up with a gum or a nasal spray.
Yeah.
So combination pharmacological therapy plus behavior. So you get more than 20%. And that's what Robert West say. If you get more than 20%, you're at a Excellent. Specialist level.
All right, okay. Lynn, I mean, first of all, I want to congratulate you. I mean, obviously, this data only came out on the 15th of March, actually published across the world on BBC, CNN. And you managed to get, you know, hunt down the researcher, the Nicola, researcher. You know, Lindzen Howley.
In Our intrepid producer,
Absolutely.
Tina.
Absolutely. Oh, all the way from congrats. Here to find it. I mean, obviously, this is a very important study. I mean, Professor Aniki came up with some data in Malaysia. You know, obviously in Malaysia, we have so many people who are addicted to this condition, right? Okay, or the cigarette.
More than 4 million.
More million.
More than that.
I don't smoke. I've never smoked, so I will never understand this. So I want to ask you guys, why is it so hard to quit?
To put it simply, it's because of nicotine. Nicotine is
it's a drug, really.
It's a drug, exactly, Josh.
It's even more addictive than heroin and morphine, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Really?
How so?
A lot of people who are addicted to heroin and morphine, they could quit that, but they still can't quit the smoking because mostly the drug addicts, they started off with smoking.
Right.
They can't quit the smoking part.
So they can quit hard drugs, but they can't quit cigarette.
Yeah. Yes, because nicotine is a very addictive chemical that upon inhalation reaches the brain within 10 seconds.
Right.
And then its concentration is high enough to produce this euphoric feeling due to the stimulation of the receptors. I'm not going to get too technical, I hope. Okay. But
we're following you.
Yeah. It's because of the release of chemicals. One of the most important chemicals is dopamine.
Right.
And dopamine, from the name dope, it means that you get this pleasurable effect.
You get a bit dopey as well.
Yes. So they know that when they smoke, they get almost instantaneous pleasurable effects.
And euphoria.
Yeah, and they keep repeating it because there's a component what we call as tolerance. Tolerance means you need more of the same substance to produce similar or heightened effects. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that what happened for a cigarette smoker is that when they inhale this, that within 10 seconds, this nicotine will actually go up to their brain, will release a feel-good hormone,
exactly.
And then they become dependent on it, and then they also build up tolerance towards it.
Yes.
And that's why it's such a hard habit to kick.
Yes, it has been rated by addiction specialists like Henningfield Benowitz on the scale of 6, is it 6?
Right.
In ability to cause dependence. That's why Dr. Zariha said it's higher than that of heroin or cocaine.
Oh, right. And there are 4 million of you out there in Malaysia who are really having this euphoria every day.
Yes.
So the participants in the study were also provided nicotine replacements and behavioural support. I asked Dr. Lindzen Howley if the quit rates would be much lower without these factors.
Yes, most certainly. And we know that because there's a very big evidence base that has told us that people are much more likely to give up smoking if they seek the help of a health professional to do so, and also if they use treatments such as nicotine replacement therapy.
How widely available is nicotine replacement therapy in Malaysia?
Okay, very good question. Actually, in Malaysia, the nicotine replacement therapy products are under Group C poisons.
Mm.
So it is sold by licensed health professionals, mainly through pharmacies. So you can actually go and buy the nicotine replacement therapy products from your pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
They are also available in the government side under the hospitals and clinics, health clinics, through the quit smoking clinics. So they're also dispensed by pharmacists.
And this is quite different from another country where people can just turn up to a, let's say, 7-Eleven or a sundry stores and just buy it.
Exactly, exactly. In some countries, they are available, as we call them, OTCs, over-the-counter medications. So they can just be bought at the supermarkets and things like that.
But even if you go to the pharmacies, you don't really need to. You don't need a doctor's prescription. You know, no prescription required.
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is cold turkey, I think, is really the best way forward. But any way you choose to quit smoking is good, and any day you choose to quit smoking is a good day. But moving on, we also covered legal matters.
Every now and then, medical legal cases are highlighted in the news. Medical negligence and a more litigious society, is that a good thing or a bad thing? First, Dr. George Lee highlighted the importance of this conversation.
Mira really has eyes for hot topics, and this one really kind of hit a lot of raw nerves. I mean, first of all, I think it has to be highlighted that, you know, a lot of us don't really know how long do your doctors have to keep your record and what are your rights when it comes to it. And Sharon Weeb, absolute perfect person to talk about that. The second thing, which as doctors, we have to take up indemnity insurance. And then you can speak to any obstetricians and then your heart just sink every time you actually discuss indemnity insurance. And, you know, for my specialty, it's urology, and then it's considered high risk. And then in a typical year, I probably have to pay about 20,000 and going up by about 10 to 15% every year. But for an obstetrician, it is actually, you know, you when you see the table, you actually say, to discuss, you know, because that's right.
Are they the highest in terms of indemnity?
One of the highest.
One of the highest.
Who would be higher than them?
Neurosurgeons. Cosmetic surgeons. Plastic and reconstructive surgeons.
You know, we're probably going to get some obstetrics, doctors calling in to say, yes, it is very, very high.
It is very, very difficult. But it's a very difficult line to be in as
it
well.
It is. It's obviously
because it's two lives to begin with. It's two lives.
Perhaps two litigations, right? Which is what this case is about, right? Potentially two litigation, but the son's one was thrown out, the wife's one carried on, right?
At the moment.
And here's the backstory of the case in question.
So you want to quickly give us the backstory and whether or not we have had similar cases here in Malaysia?
Plenty of cases. But prior to that, maybe about this case alone. Mm-hmm. Now, what has happened in this case is that the Sessions Court and the High Court said the family came too late. But the Court of Appeal said, no, we still may have, because there could be still an arguable case and go back, taking into consideration a few circumstances on the case. For example, that the entire medical records were not given. So that's a special circumstance in this case.
Are they obliged to give you the medical records?
In Malaysia, the case laws have been, yes, the case laws have been very consistent and say the medical records ought to be given to the patients, a copy of the medical records. We do have a Private Healthcare Act that actually says that, and High Court judges have been interpreting it in a favour of patients, and they'll have to give a copy. So that's a good position. Now, but in this case, what the allegation against the doctors, but we cannot discuss so much about this case because we're still going to go back to the Sessions Court for the full trial. So the limitation,
even in Malaysia, we're not allowed to discuss it.
Well, if the case is still pending in court, we shall not because we do not want to influence.
What's that word again?
Sub judice.
Sub judice, yes.
Sub judice. Sub judice. We'll be all in contempt of court. Sitting outside. We'll be going to prison if we do.
No.
I still want to lead.
We still want to pop into Singapore, because presumably
jurisdiction-wise, it's still Singapore, but I think we should show the respect, of
course.
Medical legal expert Sharon Palani explained the rights of the patient and what you can do if you suspect medical negligence.
The limitation period is strict and it has to be complied with. If someone dies, you have within 3 years to actually to initiate what we call a dependency claim. Dependents are the wives, the children. So within 3 years, you have to file a suit. But for if it's a private hospital, if it's a government hospital, within 3 years, either a dependency claim or an estate claim, you have to file it within 3 years.
And so this is particularly to pregnancy and delivery?
It does not matter as long as any personal injury. So in this case, if a child is, the mother's died and the family is going to file what we call a dependency claim for the child as the husband and the husband as well, you have to do it within 3 years.
Is it the same in Malaysia for 3 years?
Yes, it's the same. It's Malaysia. Right. So in that sense, this case, he has actually gone above that. Mm-hmm. But he has got a reason why he has gone above that. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Court of Appeal actually looked at. And there's a lot of allegations against the doctor, which we do not know, and we shall not get into it.
Okay. Right.
But the similar provisions in Malaysia is this. If you have a case, if you're a dependent, file it as soon as possible, within 3 years. The simple reason is because evidential value. Your documents, they become stale over time. So that's something. And memories, you know, it starts to fade. So one other thing is the court would like parties to come forward quickly and let this, you know, be done with quickly rather than to wait. So I would say don't wait for 3 years. Come as quickly if you think you have.
How do we know if the hospital or the medical center or, you know, the hospital is giving us all the records?
Everything.
Yeah.
Well, the hospital has, that's where I think the problem is, because the private health care actually states give a copy, but the hospitals will say no, it's under the Act, it's not explicit that I have to give you a copy. But our judges, credit goes to them, they have decided, we have got decided decisions that says you must give a copy to the patients. And in England, we have access to medical records. In Singapore, the patient can actually access their medical records where? To a certain extent.
Is that not possible online in Malaysia?
It's called Health Hub in Singapore.
Online.
Certain part and certain information of the patient can be extracted from that online application called Health Hub. I did a bit of research on that.
Wow.
So, but not everything, but to a certain, and must be by authorized people. So in
Singapore, yeah, because otherwise you have confidential so records.
And I think in Singapore they slapped the doctor's wrist and said that you cannot access a patient's record when you're not, the patient is not your patient.
Mm.
So that was very good precedent in Singapore where they actually, I think they fined the doctor. So in Singapore, you can access medical record. In UK, it's under an act you can actually access medical records. But in Malaysia, because of the Private Healthcare Act, which is not explicit, but like I said, the judges have said patients are entitled for copies of it.
What I wanted to say was that in Malaysia, increasingly we're also heading towards more and more perhaps, medical legal cases and things like that. But do you agree with that? And then also, on one hand, it's good because at the end of the day, is patient safety come first?
Absolutely.
On the other hand, I feel that many doctors increasingly are taking the, not avoiding doing risky operation in order to put themselves into that situation. Because when you have an 89-year-old man who cannot pass urine, and then the easiest thing for you to say is, I don't want to treat you. And I really think, on the other hand, it's not fair for patients also, because we are not helping the patient to take that risk for them. So that is a double-edged sword. What do you say about that?
Communication. The doctor-patient relationship. You've got to communicate with your patient. You've got to tell them, look, I'm going to do this, but there are these risks. You got to be aware of this risk. If you find that the person, explain to them in a manner where they can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the reason why, in my opinion, medical legal cases have arisen is because there's a breakdown
in communication. Which is majority of cases, right?
Yes. If you communicate and you explain, look, I have to cut this off, but there are risks of these things happening. But if I don't do it, these will happen.
Mm.
So I think that if you have that kind of open communication and the patient can actually informed about it and make a decision after all their options been given, then you have a patient who is more satisfied with the care rendered.
Mm.
Otherwise, they go like, they didn't tell me that.
Yeah. The other thing which I think from the medical legal implications of that, many doctors also practice defensive medicine, which
lately.
Is like, lately, which is something that I think also not doing patients any favour. For example, just to be on a safe side and more controlled situation, more caesarean sections to be in a more controlled situation,
yes.
And as many tests as possible to protect the doctor rather than protect the patients, because you just don't want to be in that sort of situation. What do you think about that?
I think it's very, very sad.
Because
I think, doctors, I tell myself this, no doctor steps out of his house that day and say, whose leg I'm going to cut. Doctors are trained to care. They are there to provide a service for human. And I think that the value in that. But the moment something goes wrong, they have most of the doctors I've had are like, oh my God, just don't say anything and hope it'll go away. No, it doesn't go away.
Mm.
Have that open communication. Talk to the patient. And the moment you get a letter from the lawyer, try like the records, Eventually, you're going to have to release it.
So eventually, you have to face it.
Face it. So I think that's very important. And the misperception comes from the patient when they say that the request for the records are turned down and no reasonable answer is given.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the patient's going to get angry.
Yeah.
And that's something I think that we have to look at.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Your message.
My message is, I think that the moment a patient has anything, just if you're going in the private centre, exercise the grievance mechanism. If you have something that you were not happy about, try to use the in-house mechanism first before you see a lawyer.
Mm.
That's my message.
Which is
in the grievance mechanism within the private hospital.
Okay. George?
Well, my message.
I know you had a lot of questions, so much concerns. I can see it written all over your face.
Well, it's just like, we have rare opportunity to have Sharon on the show. And then, of course, I just want to say that I agree with you. Communication is the key to avoid any litigations.
Next week, we'll be covering more of Dr. George's shows in the second half of the year. They'll be right at the end, again on a Friday, because that is, I think, really a day that Dr. George has made his own on our show. But we did take less of a clinical 101 style and we went more into medical culture. Let us know if that was an approach you enjoyed. Again, keep in touch with us at biggerpicture@bfm.my. And if you missed any part of these shows or you'd like to listen to them in full, you can just look up Dr. George Lee, both on our website, bfm.my, or on our app. We're, of course, right in the middle of the festive season, and this weekend is perhaps going to be the most festive of all. It is going to be Christmas. We hope wherever you're celebrating that you have a really good one. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas. And if you need some diet advice, we have those shows all in our podcast.
You have been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.